Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Placer, the owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, my co-host and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Holm.
Hey there.
And our guest this week from Farsight Studios, the lead designer for the Pinball Arcade, Bobby King.
Hey, Josh. Hey, Ken. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. First things first, congratulations on another successful Kickstarter for the Terminator 2 pinball rights.
Thanks. Yeah, we're very excited to bring the Terminator 2 pinball table into the Pinball Arcade. This Kickstarter is a little closer than the other two. We had one for Twilight Zone and Star Trek The Next Generation that we were pretty confident, you know, halfway through that we were going to get there. This one was pretty much like trending to be like right on the money. But thankfully, we had a really strong last week and we got there. So we can't wait to bring it out.
Yep. And we're going to talk more about the Kickstarter later on in the cast. To begin with, for people who aren't familiar with Farsight Studios or the Pinball Arcade in general, could you talk a little bit about the studio and what exactly the Pinball Arcade is?
Sure. I'll give you the brief history. Farsight Studios was created over 20 years ago now by Jay Abernolte. He started the company in his dorm room at Caltech, originally doing educational software. And it wasn't too long after that he started making console games, specifically sports games. David Crane's Amazing Tennis led to making first-party football games for Sega, and that led to making games like ESPN NFL Primetime and a bunch of plug-and-play toys. And we've made a lot of party games, casual games, some educational software. And back in 2001, 2002, we had this action puzzle game called Mojo, which is a ball that rolls around and solves puzzles. And our publisher was like, hey, could you guys make us a pinball game? And they specifically wanted us to design some original tables. Back then, having very little design experience in pinball, we were talking to them, and we thought it'd be more interesting and a better product if we actually licensed classic tables and recreated them and brought them back out. So that's the franchise, the Pinball Hall of Fame, was born with the Gottlieb collection, and that was very successful, and it led to us making a Williams collection for the Pinball Hall of Fame, which eventually led to us having all the rights to, you know, these specific Williams tables, Gottlieb tables, and eventually Bally tables and Stern tables. So when digital distribution came around, which is something we've been hoping for, you know, a couple decades now, so that we can be our own publisher, it was obvious that Pinball should be the first game that we do, since we have the licenses, we have the expertise to make pinball games, and we have a strong fan base of people who, you know, were looking forward to us not only continuing to make pinball tables, but specific tables that we haven't come out with yet. So that led to the Pinball Arcade, which is now out there pretty much in every platform you can imagine. And we're proud to publish it, and we're glad it's doing really well.
Now, before you joined Farsight, did you have any experience in terms of the pinball industry or like competitive pinball?
Myself, no. My background was always in video game development. And when it came to pinball, I grew up in the 80s and in the arcades in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, pinball was actually pretty popular still, but only like a few tables. It wasn't like the arcades were dominated by them. And I sort of trend playing video games, but I learned an appreciation for pinball and, you know, some specific tables. Ironically, Terminator 2 is one of them that I really liked when I was growing up. So I never actually played competitively. And honestly, back then, I wasn't very good. I've learned a lot of things, you know, from making the game, from understanding pinball design, and from being friends now with, you know, some of the top players in the world. There's just a lot of things that you can learn to improve your skills quite a bit.
Yeah, definitely. I was watching some of the videos that you were talking about in the interview. I think it was like the pinball organization, the Papa mm-hmm. tutorials.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely fascinating to see just how much control there actually is in pinball when you reach that competitive or professional level.
Yeah, it's stunning, really, to watch someone who's really good at pinball, the control they have on the ball. They'll catch it with the flippers, they'll hit a shot, and then they'll regain control of it. And it's very systematic, and it almost seems like there's no chance for them to lose a ball. Of course there is. Mm-hmm. They actually set up the tables to be harder for these top players in tournaments. But when you're watching them play on a pretty easy machine, they don't die. They just play forever.
How do they make it harder for competitive play versus regular play?
A few things. They make the outlanes as wide as possible. The slope of the table, the tilt downwards, they maximize. There's a lot steeper than it would be, you know, in a game that's set up in an arcade. Sometimes they'll make the slingshots more sensitive. So when the ball starts, you know, bouncing off a slingshot towards the outlane, even a really good player doesn't have that much control because it can just get sent right to the outlane. It's, you know, too fast to save. Those are a few ways. And the rules are set up in such a way that you don't get extra balls as often as you would normally. And when so if they can't earn extra balls, they have to do as much as they can with that single ball and score points, as opposed to using their time with each ball to earn more extra balls, which is one of the reasons why they can pretty much last forever. It's if the settings allow them to keep earning extra balls, they'll never run out of balls.
Yeah, for myself, I wasn't big a competitive pinball player either. The best I actually got was 95 or 96, that I got the high score for Star Trek, not TNG, but the original. Mm-hmm. And that got recorded in Twin Galaxies. So I don't know if that record's still there, but who knows, maybe I still hold the world record for that game.
Cool.
Now, with the Pinball Arcade, as the lead designer, what work do you do on a day-to-day basis with Pinball Arcade?
Yeah, specifically. Well, I'm also the VP of product development, so my role here is more the general manager of the studio, making sure that all of our projects stay on time and on budget. But specifically for the Pinball Arcade, I'm kind of in charge of licensing. So when it comes to going out there and trying to find the ancillary licenses that we need, you know, choosing the themes and the tables that we'll be coming out with from Bally and Williams and Gottlieb and Stern. And then I also do a lot of the marketing and PR stuff. But as far as the actual game, I was one of the people who designed the physics engine update that we did. We're on our third generation of physics right now. So the second generation was a pretty big step up. And when we made that step, I basically created this huge toolbox of physics tuning things I can do for the table. So to this date, I'm still the one who, after the artists are done with the modeling of the collision, and they get that to code, and then they tie in all the different switches, and all the gameplay, I'm the one who takes it and tunes it to play like the real table. So I still did that for each table we do.
Now, you said that you're on the third generation of the physics engine.
Mm-hmm.
How has things, I guess, transitioned from first to second to third? I guess if you can give us like a quick rundown.
Sure. The first physics engine was really just based on that action puzzle game I was talking about before, where you have a ball rolling around. And it was just basically like we added a few more features, but the physics were very unsophisticated when it came to like fast motion collision. Mm-hmm. So when the flippers had to hit the ball and we had to tune shots off the flipper, it was really rough. Like we had, like maybe 10 different angles the ball can come off the flippers at. So it made hitting specific shots impossible until we improved basically collision work and improved the gravity of the ball. And we added the ability to create different object types. Like pretty much anything on the table could be part of an object type group or its own specific object that needs to be tuned separately. So that was the big change into the second generation. And the third generation has really been fine-tuning that, adding a little bit more ability for us to add all these different toys that we have to support. And it's just been really like an evolution of the second generation. But it's allowed us to do stuff that allows us to give the player more abilities to control the ball, like allows for passing shots and catching.
Now, one thing you were talking about a few minutes ago regarding Farsight becoming its own publisher and developer, that's been pretty interesting as you talk about first started out as your typical game studio with having a publisher. Now, I know from history that you guys had some trouble with the Xbox, I think it was the Xbox Live or Xbox 360 version of the Pinball Arcade. Your publisher, I think they went bankrupt. Was that Crave Entertainment?
That was, yeah, Crave.
Yeah, so with the big transition from a retail to digital, are there any elements that Farsight actually misses from those old days, or has it just been completely positive now with the move to a digital format?
It's been almost completely positive. It's a lot more work. You know, our business model back then was we were contracted to make a game, and we had milestones, and when we were done with a game, it was pretty much shipped and we moved on to the next one. So our deadlines were, they didn't all get out to the public. With now, we release two tables a month on mobile, and we're behind that a little bit on console, but it's pretty much the same pace, maybe a little bit slower. So we have deadlines now because we're constantly updating the game, and this particular game is driven by DLC and add-ons, that it just seems like it's a lot more pressure to deliver something that is fully tested and ready to be released, as opposed to developing a traditional game that you have like a year until it's, you know, one big release.
And as you mentioned in the interview, it usually takes for, say, a few months per table to go from getting the table, restoring it, and then breaking it down to digitize it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we're always working. You know, some of the people at our site are working for the tables 2 months down the road, while other people are trying to finalize and get all the bugs squashed out of the release that's coming out like in a week.
Now, one question I know a lot of people have been asking, both on the Kickstarter and just some of the fans, regarding the Xbox version, I know you guys had an issue with the rights and the licensing. Is there any, like, positive outlook in terms of getting more updates for the Xbox version of the Pinball Arcade?
Yeah, we're definitely not going to leave our 360 customers just hanging out there. The 360 version is actually my personal favorite to play, and I tune it on 360. There's been some really good news this week about Xbox or Microsoft, you know, allowing for digital publishing without having a retail publishing license. So as we learn more about that, that's probably going to be our focus when it comes to getting the people with the 360 versions up to date. Because our plan is, you know, we'd like to be the publisher of it. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to make sure that everyone who's bought something or anything that they bought, they also get in whatever the version that we publish is. But, you know, we're not 100% sure of what that process is going to be yet. All I can guarantee is that we're going to make sure everyone gets what they already paid for, and then they'll be able to buy everything that we've already come out with, you know, on the mobile and on the PSN side.
Yeah, that's good. All right, so let's move on and talk a little bit about how Farsight has transitioned to Kickstarter and the challenges that is in getting the rights that way. So my first question is, as we talked about, Farsight basically planned to move to a digital format as the market changed. When you guys first started with the Pinball Arcade, or just with pinball design in general, did you have a plan to, I guess, move to crowdfunding, or did that sort of develop as Kickstarter and Indiegogo became more popular?
Yeah, that we did not have that plan from the get-go at all. It's as we went out, you know, we knew basically, you know, there's all these best tables of all time. So as we went out and we tried to get the different licenses, and we saw just how expensive they are, it seemed like we would never be able to do those tables. So, you know, we started with Twilight Zone. We're like, great, this is how much the licenses would cost. And so we made up to our fans. So if you guys can pay for the license, you know, we'll pay for making the game, and we'll come up with that table. It's been really a great way for us to get all the best tables of all time, you know, out there to our customers and to the fans and to the people who want to play them. Because I think without Kickstarter, we probably would just be at this impasse with the additional licenses that, you know, we can't afford that. And we can't make money on this table if we're going to spend basically more than our profit margin on the license alone.
Yeah, especially what you were showing with the prices for the Terminator 2. Was that the most expensive in terms of rights so far that you asked for Kickstarter?
Yes, it is. Because the movie license and the actor, Arnold Schwarzenegger's license, had to be separate, and they were both pretty big guarantees. That was, guarantee-wise, that was the highest number we've had to pay.
Now, earlier you talked about how you're also responsible for managing the rights, getting them from the various IP holders. So when you go about starting, you know, getting a Kickstarter project going, what does that like entail? Is it just as simple as like calling up like the studio, or is there a lot more that goes into, I guess, just the early negotiations?
Yeah, there's a lot more that goes into it, and it's a very slow process. Licensing in general, it seems that licensors are never in a big hurry to get you a license. We have to agree to terms, so we have to come to pretty much a contract, final agreeable contract, before we can run a Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. Because we need to know exactly what they want and whether or not this deal is going to be feasible. We can't have a Kickstarter and then have the license negotiations fall through.
Yeah, of course.
So it has to be pretty much a done deal as far as terms. And getting to terms can sometimes take 6 months to a year. And sometimes there's exclusivities that you have to work around, where licensors either don't want to give you a license until a certain date, or they want to be insured that you're going to be having your product come out within a certain time window.
Now, in terms of getting the rights for each one of these tables, when you finally do succeed and you get the rights, does that allow you just to make like one version of that table, or does it allow you, you know, as long as you keep making the Pinball Arcade, or if you make like another game in the future, to use those rights again, or is it just for that one time?
It's an agreement that gives us the rights to come out with that table, and we specify the Pinball Arcade, but over a certain term limit, which is usually 3 years. So we can sell the game within a 3-year window of signing the deal. I don't know if that answers the question, but that's pretty standard to our deals.
Now, after that 3 year, do you have to reapply for the contract, or are you like just not allowed to sell it, period?
We would not be allowed to sell it unless we get an extension on it. And usually, to get an extension, all they're looking for is another guarantee. of, you know, what they're going to be, what we're able to pay them essentially to extend the deal. So yeah, it's not like, the 3 years are up and then we have to pull the game from shelves. You know, it's, at the worst case, we wouldn't be able to sell that table anymore.
Okay. Now, one thing that was mentioned on the actual Kickstarter was how with each Kickstarter that Farsight is accomplishing, it's sort of helping building up your credibility. Is that true in terms of making it easier to secure more rights?
I think in general, when it comes to licensing, when you go out, when you're trying to contact a licensor, and you know, this is actually part of the process I didn't really get into, but when you're going to approach, like, say, like Disney for Pirates of the Caribbean or Fox for Simpsons Pinball Party, they're very reluctant to give you a license to anything unless you can prove the quality of your game, and you can also ensure that you have other, you know, properties that are, you know, signing on board, which has really helped. So I think moving forward, there's a couple licenses that we're going to be able to get now. At least we'll be able to figure out exactly what the license holder would want to have us come out with that table that we wouldn't, or we were not able to like 2 years ago when I first started contacting licensors, and I gave them the this is the amount of money that we can actually afford to pay, and they were like, that's not worth it to us. You know, go away.
Now, as we talk about, Terminator 2 is, of course, the third Kickstarter from Farsight. Has it gotten easier for each Kickstarter, or do you still sweat it out when you start the Kickstarter?
We definitely sweated out T2, and I think the reason was our fulfillment wasn't 100% as well as we could have done it for the first two, for Twilight Zone and Star Trek, when it came to giving people their vouchers, their T-shirts, stuff like that, that were actively trying to make sure we're, you know, getting everyone 100% fulfilled to the other Kickstarters, in addition to we have a whole new staff dedicated to guaranteeing that we get everything out to the T2 guys. So I think part of it was some of our fans were like, yeah, you know, you guys have, you know, didn't treat your backers as well as, you know, you guys could have. So maybe I'll give a little less. I won't go for this tier or that tier. But I think moving forward is if we are able to, you know, get more, you know, big name licenses that people are dying for us to recreate. And once we prove that our fulfillment is where it should be, then I think it should be starting to improve. But yeah, this, the T2 one, we knew was going to be a bit of a problem because we, you know, we had a lot of growing pains, you know, being a developer into a publisher, you know, and then add that Kickstarter fulfillment is not something that we're set up for. We're mainly programmers and artists with a very small production staff. So we're staffing up on that end, and I think we're getting better.
Yep. Now, with the Terminator 2 Kickstarter, you could go back and do it again. Were there any, like, mistakes or hiccups that you would try to fix a second time around?
None that I can think of. We knew it was going to be a problem because of the other Kickstarters, but that'd be, you know, in the past before this one even started. I can't think of anything during this Kickstarter that we would have done different.
All right. Now, at the end of the Kickstarter, there's the hint at the next Kickstarter project being for the Addams Family, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, do you have a time frame for when that Kickstarter will go up, or are you still in, like, the deliberation process?
Yeah, we're still in the negotiations to getting an exact number of what all the licenses would cost, because you're talking about the movie rights, the Addams Family Foundation rights, and then a bunch of different actor likenesses. And I should know, actually, probably in like a couple weeks, I'll have a better answer to that question. You know, the Kickstarter won't start in a couple weeks, but I'll know pretty much how long it'll be take until we have some numbers.
Now, when you do the negotiation for the rights, I think you mentioned with the Terminator 2, there was like a limited time that they were being offered. Is that mm-hmm. the same case for each one, or is that just specifically for Terminator?
So the term rights, you mean, for T2?
For how long they give you to, I guess, raise the money, or how long the rights are on the table.
Yeah, for T2, we only have the rights to that, to the movie license for 2 years. So once we come out with it, once we initially release the table, people will only be able to buy it for 2 years. And then after that, they can still play it, but we just won't be able to sell it. And that's different for every table. And usually it's 3 years. So when it comes to Addams Family, we'll, of course, be going for 3 years. And as far as the amount of time that the Kickstarter, you know, we seem to like 30 days is a good number that we found works. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I tried to.
I think the part that I was talking about was when you talked about on the Kickstarter for Terminator 2, one of the comments was that you only had a certain amount of time that the rights were being offered to
yes.
actually get the contract. That's what I was referring to.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a very unique case then, because the people with the movie rights were basically, you need to come out by this date, and then you can only have 2 years from that date. So if we went any further into the future, like, we'd be even less than 2 years. So that we thought is our one shot was to get it, you know, done in these 30 days and get this table out as quick as we can.
In terms of negotiation, you talked about one issues being the money, how much you're asking for. Are there any other, like, major hurdles that are being dealt with on the negotiation tables for getting the rights?
There's the back end, the royalty rate that they want. There's a huge range of what different licensors are expecting or wanting. And if that number is way too high, and if there's too many licenses, like with the Addams Family, you know, we're very hopeful that we'll be able to come up with an arrangement that'll work for everyone. But if each of these nine actors wants like 10% of the net receipts, we can't give away 90% of the net receipts. I mean, that's not going to work. So we need to hopefully they'll be reasonable and want some sort of guarantee that is, you know, fair, and that their back end is not going to prevent us from having a deal that will work at all.
And, of course, with each of the license tables, the IP or license holders, they receive, like, a cut of whatever profit you make on it during the 2 or 3 year period, correct?
Yeah, everyone. I mean, the manufacturer does. They get their cut, and then the any ancillary rights gets their cut. So that's why we want to keep it as limited as we can.
Okay, let's move on and talk about somewhat of a bombshell you revealed on our interview last week regarding Farsight's plans for perhaps going to making original tables.
Mm-hmm.
Now, last week you sort of hinted at that in the interview. Do you have any more you could tell us about what that entails for Farsight in the future?
Yeah, I can't talk too much about it because it's still very preliminary and I don't want to promise anything that we're not going to eventually deliver on. But, you know, we were actually fans of the pinball construction set way back when by EA, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And even as limited as that was, how fun it was to create your own pinball table. So we have in place, you know, a pretty sophisticated tool set of creating tables that we think would make a great, you know, tool and a great game for fans of pinball to create their own tables. So we're currently working at making it as completely as user-friendly as possible while still being powerful to be able to make a really deep table with a, you know, a scripting language built in so that you can have a deep rule set and some sort of, you know, story mode and stuff like that.
Now, besides having the actual editor, is Farsight going to try their hand at making pinball designs as well?
Absolutely. Again, I can't be too revealing of what those tables would be or what licensing you might go for or anything like that, but we've definitely been talking around the office about different things that we'd like to do, and, you know, some original tables that don't have licenses that we know now that we've had so much experience making pinball tables that we're pretty sure we can make some really fun tables with certain themes.
Definitely. Now, in our interview, you mentioned like some of like the legendary designers for, I think, Star Trek, Twilight Zone. What was his name? Steve Ritchie. Has he had a chance to like look at the Pinball Arcade or comment on that?
Yeah, yes. He was at the Texas Pinball Festival that we were at a few months ago. He was playing the game on all the different platforms. And this is not the first time he's played. He works at Stern now. He actually designed Metallica and AC/DC. Sorry. So yeah, he's still very active in the pinball world, and he's a great designer. And we've talked to him about a bunch of things.
Now, when we talk about making original tables, we will, of course, have to mention Zen Studios. Mm-hmm. They're, of course, the makers, for people who aren't aware, they make the Pinball FX platform, and they deal with completely original digital tables. They don't do any physical or any kind of digitizing on that front. Now, have you had a chance to try out any of the Pinball FX2 tables?
Yeah, we have, and I have specifically. I played some of their original tables, you know, a few years ago, and I've tried my hand at a couple of the Star Wars tables they came out with, and actually the Marvel tables as well. And yeah, they do a great job. They make some really fun virtual, like sort of fantasy pinball that it's, you know, I think that when we create our own original designs, we're going to lean more towards stuff that you could do in the real world. It won't be 100%. I'm sure we'll you know, bend the reality a little bit, but we want it to feel like you're playing a machine that could possibly exist, you know, in a real arcade. For that reason, I think our tables will have a different feel than theirs. I personally find their tables to be fun for a little bit, then I get a little bored of them. I think they're tuned kind of easy as well, and they're not the deepest. The tables that we're recreating, especially some of these classics that have multiple modes and you can play for hours and hours and never see half the things. There's a certain feeling of depth there that a lot of those Zen tables don't have.
I was watching footage of The Twilight Zone, which I think it's been considered like the most complicated table ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that stuff is just like crazy of all like the little things on the table and that multi-ball, which is insane to like watch. All of a sudden the whole thing just explodes in lights.
Right. Yeah, they did a great job with the presentation of multi-ball on the table. But I don't know if you know, like our game has an instruction mode that basically teaches you how to play the tables. And got to forget the exact number, but I think it's Twilight Zone's like 700 pages long.
Nice.
And it's just page after page of like how all the different modes and then how they're interwoven. And like if you're in this mode, then you do this thing, then this changes. And it gets really deep, and mastering all those little details of the gameplay is almost impossible. That's why, yeah, it's kind of like the first place that's ever anyone's ever attempted to put it all down and write in some sort of way that you can go through.
Yeah, in the interview last week, you mentioned in terms of having challenges with recreating or digitizing tables, you mentioned, I think, Teed Off as one of the ones you had trouble with. Mm-hmm. Was the Twilight Zone like equally or more like challenging to actually get that into the pinball arcade?
Oh, much easier. But it's because Teed Off was really hard because we had to rewrite the rules.
Okay.
It's not ROM emulated, so when we went to script it, a programmer had to basically play the table and move the ball around and try to learn. So he could recode these really complex rule sets. And by really complex, nothing compared to Twilight Zone. Like, I don't know how long it would take to reprogram Twilight Zone. It would probably take like a year. And I'm not exaggerating. Like, it would take like a programmer, if you wanted to make it like, and it still wouldn't be 100% accurate. That's like 95 to 99% accurate. It takes the pinball team that actually made that real table, a solid year to make it. And they're not trying to recreate something that has to be exactly the way it was in real life. So we probably have a lot of bugs and stuff to work out that when we got things wrong. But yeah, I'd say because we have ROM emulation, all we need to do is get all the switches, all the lights, all the gameplay of the different areas hooked up and reacting right, and then the ROM takes care of all the rules.
And that's why you said in the interview is how important it is to have that ROM emulation for each cabinet in the pinball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without it, we wouldn't be able to do like these tables from the 90s, there'd be no way.
Now, and regarding Zen Studios, I've been playing it myself over the last few weeks. Like you, I think I like a lot of how just out there their table designs are, that there are things that you really couldn't do. But I think the one that's always got me is the physics just feels slightly off to me with how the ball responds, and it really just messes up my aim, personally.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. The Zen people would disagree with you. Yeah. They think their physics are better than ours, which I think ours are way better. But again, I'm biased since I'm designing it and tuning it to be as real as I can possibly make it. So it's hard for me to comment about that too much.
So before we wrap it up, just a few more general questions. I know if I don't ask, my friends will yell at me next week when I post this cast. Regards to the pinball arcade, I know Farsight recently got that greenlit on Steam. What time frame are you shooting for to actually have it launch and avail?
Oh, T2?
No, the actual pinball arcade on the Steam platform.
On Steam, oh, sorry. We are very, very, very close to putting out the closed public beta, and I'm imagining it's not going to be more than 4 weeks in public beta. So end of August is still very much possible.
And regarding T2, when are you shooting for that to be available for everyone?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We want to get it out there as soon as we possibly can. So during the Kickstarter, we may or may not have already started in anticipation of getting there, because, well, we love this table, and we were going to make sure. I can't really give you an exact date, but all I can tell you is that we are hopeful that it'll be a lot sooner than you expect.
Cool. And earlier you mentioned with the Adams family that you're still in the negotiation process, so we still have an exact timing for when that Kickstarter will start, right?
Right. And I really think that in 2 weeks from today or tomorrow, I'll have a better feel for when that Kickstarter would be.
And I guess here's my last question for you. Obviously, like me, you're a huge fan of pinball. So if you could wave a magic wand and just pick one table that you could just magically put on Pinball Arcade, bing, bang, boom, it's done. What table would you love to see on the Pinball Arcade?
Bing, bang. Like a real table that we would magically get all the license rights for?
Yeah.
Because I'm skeptical that we'll ever be able to get it, Pirates of the Caribbean is a really fun table that I just don't, because a lot of tables I can think of, I still have hopes that we'll actually do.
Mm-hmm.
Pirates, I've made no progress with Disney to get those rights. I mean, I'll keep trying, of course, and you know, maybe someday that there'll be some sort of way that we can come to some sort of agreement of numbers that would make it worth their while. But as far as it's a one table license, they really haven't been that interested in talking to me.
All right. So Ken, do you have any questions you'd like to ask Bobby regarding Pinball Arcade or Kickstarter?
So I was just wondering, have you watched any of the interesting pinball documentaries like Special When Lit?
Yes, I've watched Special When Lit. We actually just made available in our game a documentary called The History of Pinball. And that's actually another really good one to watch that does a really good job of showing you the progress of, you know, the invention of pinball through the mid-90s. Special When Lit was very cool. There's also, and it's not really a documentary, but there's a kind of a DVD-like app that's called Pinball 101 that was done by the Elwin brothers that does a great job of explaining how to play better pinball. And I highly recommend that one, too.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I wanted to ask, because it's very interesting in terms of how the sport lives on now and how people play it now, and also how it transitioned to digital and how successful you guys have been. So it's pretty neat. And now you said you've met a lot of famous or, you know, successful players. How did you actually get into meeting these people?
Well, Josh Sharp is Roger Sharp's son, and actually Zach Sharp is the number one player in the world right now. And so, yeah, we know him through Roger Sharp, and you know, he helps out with some pro tips and playing the games and making sure that our physics are right. Roger Sharp, he's actually at WMS. He's in charge of licensing. So, and he was the number one player in the world. At one point, he's still a great player. Keith Elwin is down in San Diego, so he's relatively close. He actually came up and played some real pinball and played our game at our studio about a year ago now. There's also Roy Wills over in the Netherlands, who he was one of the winners of one of our first tournaments. So I met him that way. And other than that, it's just been going to these pinball events and just meeting the players.
Well, that's great. I think it's doing a great service in terms of not only, you know, obviously bringing it to the new masses, but preserving some of these games so they don't get lost forever.
Yeah, I think actually a documentary could be made here soon about how pinball is coming back. And so when we're going to these expos and stuff, it just seems that they're getting bigger and bigger. So I think that the mass market and the popularity of pinball is increasing to the point where it's not quite as niche as it was just 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's pinball leagues and pinball tournaments, gaining steam all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the game's getting generational too. You see a lot of families getting involved in the game itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and pinball is the kind of game where, you know, it can be. You know, it's really easy to approach. You just keep the ball alive, right? And so someone who's just 4 or 5 years old is standing on a box can enjoy it, as well as, you know, someone who's a lot better and enjoying the presentation and the depth of the game.
Definitely. And I think part of the rise of pinball over the last 5 years probably has been attributed to the Pinball Arcade and just the ease of digital distribution.
Yeah, we like to think so. We think that we've made a lot of these tables more accessible to people who don't have arcades around. They can't find working tables. We've had both happy wives and unhappy wives. The happy wives are like, you know, my husband doesn't need to buy like these 10 tables and fill up our house because now he can have them on his iPad. And the unhappy wife is like, so he didn't really even think about buying a pinball table before, and you introduced pinball to him, and now I've got 3 pinball tables in my house. And I don't mean to pick on, you know, wives, because one thing that's cool is introducing women to pinball, and specifically my mother. When she was growing up, she didn't feel like pinball was like a woman's like game or activity. So she was always just felt like she wasn't like allowed to play for whatever reason. And I introduced her to our game, and she loves it. And there's all sorts of women who are, I think, becoming introduced to pinball who have never seen it or never thought they'd be playing it.
I mean, that's the rise of the casual market too. So, I mean, there's a big stigma when it comes to pinball games, but with the rise of the casuals, I think people are a little more safer to see it on like a store, you know, for their iPad and stuff. It's actually interesting that through those documentaries, I found out that pinball itself was banned for a very long time. And because of that, Chicago became like the biggest distributor of pinball machines in the world.
Yeah, that's like I mentioned Roger Sharp earlier, and that was one of his claims to fame, is that in New York it was considered gambling, because you're putting in this quarter and you're basically gambling that through the machine you'd be able to get more credits, and then you could keep playing or sell them if you wanted to sell them to someone else who wanted to play after you. And he basically proved that there was skill involved in front of, you know, these congressmen, that it wasn't a game of just pure chance and gambling. You know, if you're a really good player, it's a game of skill. It's not, it shouldn't be categorized in the same way.
Now, one quick question. When we were just talking about how there's still more competitive leagues and professional players going on, at the pinball tournaments, are they using real machines or are they using, like, digital versions still?
Real machines.
Okay.
We're planning on going to Pinball Expo this coming October, and we want to have, like, a bigger virtual tournament using our game we've ever done before. Like, we have like, small tournaments, like, you just play a table and whoever posts the best score, like, win a t-shirt for the day. But we want to have, like, a bigger tournament that'll be kind of, like, live in addition to, I mean, our tournaments within our game. And right now we have a tournament going on between our Kickstarter backers for Twilight Zone. That's all done virtually. You know, people are playing on PSN and mobile, and whoever has the best scores, they're getting prizes. But no, I think because real pinball is relatively hard to come across, you know, as much as it was before, I think that's why when you actually go to an event or an expo and you're there on location, then having real pinball makes sense.
All right. Ken, do you have anything else you want to ask Bobby?
No, that's pretty much it.
And one last thing that I just want to say to you, Bobby, and to Farsight, just from me and my friends who love pinball, we definitely appreciate what you guys are doing at Farsight with digitizing and keeping these tables around. And as you said, it's definitely becoming harder and harder to find actual tables or actual places to play them. And it's great that you guys are providing this for the fans and the newcomers.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that. I mean, that's our main goal, is to preserve this great piece of American history that's pinball, and introduce it to people who've never been able to play, and allow people who are nostalgic about it to find their favorite tables and play them again.
So with that, we're going to wrap up this cast here. As always, I would like to thank Ken for being my co-host.
Rala.
And Bobby, it was great having you on. I would love to talk to you again later more about either pinball design or about some of the future designs your guys are going to do with the original tables.
Thanks, Josh. Yeah, I appreciate it being on, and yeah, I'll do that and come back on and talk again later about some of the stuff that we're doing in the future with more detail.
So with that said, as always, I'd like to end the cast with saying that if you are interested in being a future guest or would like to write a piece for Game Wisdom, feel free to contact us at any time. You can find the link under Submissions Wanted on our front page. And with that said, thank you for tuning in to the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.
Good night.